So with that, everybody seems pretty quiet on the line. I think we're getting ready to turn things over and kick things off. I'm going to turn it over to our instructor today, who is actually coming from Israel, and it's Ofer Dahan, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing. But we're basically going to walk through Vedo Zone Monitoring, which is a novel technology that's used to provide in-situ real-time information on hydrological and chemical conditions of the percolating water in deep sections of the Vedo Zone. So I'm going to turn things over. If you're ready, feel free to go ahead and start.
If you are, if it is referred to me, I am ready.
Okay, great. I think we're going to have everyone move on to slide number 3 to begin the presentation.
Okay, can we start?
Yes, you may.
So first, thank you, Jean, for all the preparation for this presentation. And thank you all for joining. It's pretty bizarre to say good morning to you on the West Coast, good afternoon to you on the East Coast, and good evening to us here in Israel in one presentation, but here we are. I'm Ofer Dahan. I'm from Ben-Gurion University. I'm here with Shuki Bones from Amethyst. And we will present a Vedo Zone monitoring system that we have developed here over the time. If I'm not clear enough or running too fast, please interrupt me, Jean, and let me know that something is wrong, and I'll try to be slower or even clearer if I can, but I'm not sure I can do better than this. I'll just try.
Absolutely. You're doing perfectly well right now. Thank you.
So I think if we start with slide number 3, the whole issue is about Vedo Zone monitoring. And I think to all the audience, I don't know how many of you are there behind the lines. How many do you know, Jean?
You have approximately 150 people on the line right now.
Oof. Okay.
I'm all over the world.
So I don't think to all these audience we need to preach about the importance of Vedo Zone and certainly about the monitoring aspect of the Vedo Zone. No need to elaborate much on that. I think it's clear for all the people here. But what I'll try to do is to present a tool that helps us to get better information or more accurate information about what we got down there between the surface where we live to the water table where we get our water resources. And now I'll move to slide number 2. It's 2 for me, it's 4 for you, and slide number 4, which is the most obvious thing. If pollution is revealed, usually it is revealed in groundwater at first place. And then people from the EPA would come, or consultant, and they would certainly say, hey, it starts somewhere on the surface. No, it penetrated through the Vedo Zone, groundwater, and now we have a plume of contaminants or pollution in the groundwater. We know it happened in the Vedo Zone first, but we don't know much about it before it already turns into a fact in groundwater. So if I move to slide number 5, next slide, we know that once contamination is revealed, immediately or not immediately, we start with site characterization. This is a heavy operation, which usually involves with a lot of soil sampling, which is done by either, you know, simple hand tools like hand auger, to very sophisticated tools like geoprobes or sonic drilling. By the end, we collect soil samples, we extract them in different methods, and by the end, we get something which represents for us the state of contaminants in the subsurface. But what do we know about that? Let's move to this next slide, slide number 6. What we get out of it is usually a snapshot in time of what we get out of soil samples, destructive soil samples that are collected in a certain time and space. We can see on the left corner, the upper one, we can see profiles of perchloride. This is from one of our sites in Israel, which is heavily contaminated from a military industry. Bipachlorite, it's also common in the U.S. in many parts. And you can see very high concentration. These are two profiles connected from practically the same area in two different times. I think it's 1.5 year time from one to another. Again, it's a snapshot in time. It took probably 50 to 30 to 40 years. Nobody knows how long it took us to get to this profile. And what was the dynamic process that led to this profile? These are 1D collected from single boreholes or multiple boreholes. We can go to 2D representation through what we see on the right side in a picture from tracer test experiment. Again, this is something that gives us a picture on 2D distribution of tracers. This is dye. But again, it's a snapshot in time. It gives us the situation in this exact time and location. We can take this information, make it 3D representation, and get something that we see on the left corner down there. But again, this is something that we get from single measurements or multiple measurements that are collected by in a certain time, and it doesn't tell us much about the dynamic process that actually leads to that situation. We can further go further to the next slide. It's slide number 7. And to see the situation today. Today, if anywhere in the U.S., in Israel, in Europe, there is a source of potential contamination, let's say a new gas station, a new chemical facility, a new hazardous waste site, or a new treatment site, what the EPA would usually demand for continuous monitoring, even if it's not continuous, would usually be observation well. Now, these observation wells sample the groundwater below. As long as we sample it and the water is clean, then we are happy with it. But once we get already signs of contaminant in this water, we already know that it's too late. We already know that we got a plume. We already know that the bed ozone is already contaminated. And there's no much we can do about it. We will spend millions on trying to remediate it. And I don't think there was any single individual aquifer all over the world that was completely remediated to provide fresh water as it was before. So it's no more than post-mortem, if I'll be very unpolite to many of you guys there from consulting companies, but we can do a lot to prevent its migration, to reduce contaminants, but it will never come back to be an aquifer that provides fresh water. If we go to the next slide, slide number 8, we can see the concept that we thought about. If we want to prevent groundwater contamination, we must start monitoring under the potential resources right in the vessel zone and having a tool that will give us continuous information about the dynamic process of water percolation and contaminant transport in the vessel zone before it accumulates to a contamination plume in groundwater. Usually we install it in slanted borehole. It doesn't have to be slanted, but the idea of slanted boreholes comes from the fact that with slanted borehole, and it's not a borehole by the end, it is sealed, every point from the borehole to the surface represents an undisturbed sediment column, as opposed to a vertical column, which is always disturbed by the material around the borehole because of the drilling action. Practically, let's go for the next slide. In slide number 9, this is how our system looks like. This is a schematic illustration of one of our sites, but it is one-on-one the dimension of a real site. This is the site in Ashdod. It's on the coastal plain in Israel. You see a vessel zone of 21 meters, and the systems are installed in slanted boreholes, which are drilled in different angles, different directions, and every red point and green point represent a sampling section. And practically, every time we take samples, we get a 3D representation of the actual chemical and hydrological state of the vessel zone. It's not a single point in groundwater. It's multiple points in different locations under an area which is suspect as potentially can be contaminated, or just for the sake of studying the site as this particular site is. And I will come back to this site later. I'll go on for the next slide and show in a schematic illustration how is the system set. You can see on the right lower corner, a demonstration of one of the sleeves. It's a flexible sleeve. Before it is inserted into one of the holes, which is illustrated on the upper right corner. And on the left side, you see a representation of what we call a sampling unit. Every unit gets a few probes on it, but in general, almost the standard, I can call it, is a water sensor, water content sensor. It's, we call it flexible TDR, which are mounted on this flexible sleeve. And we also have some customized vedozone sampling pole, which practically it is what in the American world it is called the suction lysimeter or suction cup. It's not a cup. It's a system that allows collecting liquid water from unsaturated lung conditions, just as suction lysimeter do. But we have multiple of them, as you can see on the upper right side, installed all along the cross section. And now I'll go to the next one. You can see here a set of pictures that shows the installation process. Actually, the installation process takes no more than a couple hours to a day to a few of these systems. If you can see on the upper left corner, a sleeve. This is a pretty long one. This is 45 meter, which is almost 130-something feet in American measures. You can see on the right side, its insertion into a borehole. Actually, in this case, it's under a dairy farm or dairy farm waste lagoon. And you can see by the end, the control panel. So when we get to the field, we get information by cell phone every couple hours, or we can collect samples every couple days or every couple hours, depending on the water content, of course, but without the need to bring drilling trucks or pumps or any heavy machinery. By a couple minutes, we get water samples from the entire vedozone from few of these sleeves that you see on the upper left corner. So what it's all about? It's slide number 12 now. It's a long sentence. What is the vedozone monitoring system designed for? So I'll read it as is in order not to get confused. It's continuous real-time information on the hydraulic and chemical properties of the percolating water in deep vedozone through in situ measurements of natural undisturbed condition. Wow, I made it in one sentence. But I will try through the next slide just to show that we think or we believe or we will try to prove that we are able or capable to do it with this system in reasonable means, because, you know, for endless amount of money we can do anything, but here it's pretty simple and I'll try to demonstrate it through results from few projects. I can move now to slide number 13, and I will demonstrate through a few of the projects. Here we see a set of pictures on sites where we installed the system. This is only partial. We have more than 50 systems installed in about 15 sites between Israel, the U.S., South Africa, Namibia, Spain, and that's it. No, Portugal not yet. Anyhow, what you see on the left side is a site which is in a sand dune area. And actually what I wanted to show is the installation in a variety of terrains, hydrological and chemical setups. So on the left side you see sand dune area. On the right side you see monitoring under a stream channel which is contaminated from manure. Heavily contaminated from a dairy farm. If we go to next slide number 14, this is from a project where we investigate the influence of different agricultural setup on groundwater, On the left, it's orchard, open field crops, and greenhouses. And greenhouse, this is again partial. In the next slide, slide number 15, we can see pictures from setups in arid environments where we have coarse material, gravel material. On the upper left corner, we see an ephemeral screen, two ephemeral screens, one in Israel, one in South Africa during flood. On the right side, we can see systems which were installed under infiltration reservoirs. So finally, after 30 years of using reservoirs, we know how much water infiltrates down. And as a hint from now, I can tell you that not much, but we go forward with that. We go now to slide number 16. This is from another project on the influence of dairy farm on groundwater. I will not go to detail into this project because we have too many samples in this presentation, and I know that I have grace period of about 20 minutes before you start hanging off without even closing your eyes. So I'm still here with that. You see the sleeve while it's preparation before its installation. You see the drilling action under the waste lagoon. And you see some results for those of you who got sharp eyes. You can see the numbers, concentration in different times of both nitrogen and chloride, but this is only an example. And I'll skip to the next one, which is not less important. It will be the last one of this presentation. We'll be talking about control remediation of contaminated vessel zones and how can we use the system to improve the remediation conditions and actually have, I would say, the first time, online information about the influence of what we do on surface to the actual condition or degrading condition down below. So now I will start with a set of slides where I will demonstrate through results from some of these projects. I'm still on, or I feel alone. Is there someone there?
Oh, we're all still here, definitely. And this is Jean Ballant. Just a gentle reminder, if you do have comments or questions, by all means, you're encouraged to use that little orange question mark button along the top. Make sure your pop-up blockers are turned off. We'll open up a new window and you can submit a comment or question at any time. And if you like, we can take a break in a few minutes to do verbal questions if you'd like, just to double check.
For me, it will be a save if you can ask me questions from time to time so I will not be so alone. How I can go on automatically and speak out. But if you have questions or you feel like saying something, please don't hesitate to interrupt. It's not interrupting.
Okay. Very good. And along those lines, again, if you have a comment or question now, by all means, take your phones off of mute. And you can use #6 command to unmute your line.
Okay, so I will continue
now.
Thank you.
Now
I will go to slide number 18. And I will show some information from a project where we installed systems under stream channels in order to investigate floodwater percolation and groundwater recharge in arid land. And there's a list of publications down there you can see below. But anyhow, as you probably know, in arid environments, people, settlers, whoever live in arid environment, totally dependent on shallow alluvial aquifer, which got usually fresh water, and these are usually situated along the main stream channel. This is what I'm saying, it's usually. Of course, if you live by the Nile or by the Colorado River, the situation is different, but pretty old. Anyhow, in most deserts, groundwater is recharged by floodwater, and there is a lot of the agricultural development all over the world in arid environment. And this agricultural development, like in the Arava Valley in Israel, like in southern Spain, is heavily dependent on how much water is finally recharging these aquifers. So in this project, we wanted to investigate, during a flood event, the dynamics of floodwater percolation. And I will go to the next slide. And here you see a system installed under the stream channel of the Kwisab River. This is in Namibia. You see many trees behind, but don't be mistaken. This is a desert area with zero rain, practically zero rain. And the flood actually get water because there's floods from once or twice a year, or sometimes 3 years in a row without a flood. But anyhow, this is the stream channel and the system installed under the stream channel. On the right side, you see a pole which on top of it all the data logging and acquisition system is installed. I will go to the next slide and show what have we measured during the flood. On the left side, you see a set of schematic illustrations of what we wanted to measure. On the upper one, number A, you see the system. It's a cross-section of alluvial material and alluvial aquifer situated under a stream channel. But we know that when a flood comes in, which is B on the left side, we know that a wetting front will initiate from land surface and propagate through the weather zone, through the groundwater. And on the right side, you see some measured results. The upper one, A, flood, measured the flood hydrograph. This is pretty standard, and every flood hydrologist measures hydrographs, and sometimes we try to estimate how much water leaves the surface during a flood and try to correlate information between the flood stage to the groundwater recharge. But what we see in the figure below, this is B on the right side, weather zone, is the water content variation during the flood event at various depths. As actually, if you will look on the left side, you see the schematic illustration how the wetting front propagates from probe to probe on the slanted system installed in the subsurface. So what we see here, I'm going back to the right side, to the middle part of the right side, the weather zone. We see that at the beginning, before the flood, water contents are very low. This is volumetric water content of 4 to 6%, pretty low. But once the flood comes in and water starts to percolate, you see that number one, this is the probe at 60 centimeter, is jumping up to higher water content, not very high. Of course, it's not saturation. It's only about 13 to 14%, and it's propagating down from probe to probe, from 1 to 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on through the entire cross section until a touchdown in groundwater. And once we get a touchdown in groundwater through the weather zone, we see the groundwater start rising up. This means that we got recharge. So for a change, we don't only measure the flood on surface or the groundwater below or both of them. We close the entire system from the boundary condition up and down through the entire domain where the infiltration action actually happened. This is in the weather zone. Out of this data, we can easily calculate flow velocity. This is 1 minus 7 in time divided by the time, by the depth, and out of it, it's very easy also to calculate the flux. So you can model the flux, but you can calculate it directly out of this chart by simple multiplication. We can go on to the next slide.
Actually, I'm going to stop you. If you don't mind, we had a number of questions that came in online. Let's go through some of them. The first one comes in from, I believe it's Mississippi. And they ask, what type of sensors are used to collect the data in the VSP?
The data, what we see here, is a water content sensor that is based on TDR, but it's flexible TDR that are adopted to our flexible sleeve. So by having the flexibility of the sensor and the flexibility of the sleeve, well, the sleeve, I didn't get much into the technical aspect. This is a whole different issue. The sleeve is open and get attached to the borehole sidewalls. And finally, it is completely sealed to prevent any leaks or water flow along the borehole. So it is filled with concrete or with urethane resin, depends what we use. But we have sensors attached to an undisturbed sediment column, and these are practically by TDR technology on customized probes that we have designed for that.
Okay, and I think this also leads into the next question that's related that came in from Alabama, and you may have answered this just now. They ask you to please explain what type of well casing and screens are used or may not be used with this type of monitoring system.
Okay. If this question comes again, I will please refer you back to make it easier the explanation, if we have time, to slide number 10. It will make it easier to explain. If you can go back to slide number 10, the borehole are drilled with no casing. We use no casing for the drilling, unless we have some collapse, but usually it's even if we drill in sand dune, as you see here, or we drill in gravel in dry area, usually the boreholes in the unsaturated zone remain stable enough for a couple minutes for us to insert down the sleeve you see below. Now, the sleeve you see below is very flexible. It's made of thin liner, very thin liner, like rubber, like, depend on the size, rubber, PVC, Teflon, urethane, depend on the chemical properties of the site. Of course, if it is heavily contaminated with something which is which can attack the material, use something which is resilient for that. But it's very flexible. Now, on the left side, you see the situation in the borehole. The borehole is anyone, if I'm sure you've seen boreholes in your life, boreholes' walls are never smooth, especially uncased. And if you drill in gravel material, as you see in this picture, you will get very unsmooth borehole walls. Now, the sleeve with the probes, the flexible probe, including the VST, the sampling probe, including the FTDR, are very flexible. So once it gets into the borehole, it is filled from the inside with liquid concrete or urethane, which opens up the sleeve to attach the probes, the sensor, directly to the wall. Few hours or few minutes later, depend on the material we use as filling material, the material solidifies and the probes are secure in place because of the flexibility. Then, and we already excavated few of these out of the boreholes and we made couple tracer tests and we checked it. We had no a single incident until now of preferential flow along these boreholes because of the boreholes, because they are completely sealed by that sleeve, which is a very flexible packer, like flexible sleeve. Not like, it's not like truck tire. It's more like like laboratory latex gloves. So when it is in the borehole, it fills the entire void, attach the sensors to the wall, and prevent flow along it. Now, the flexibility of the sensor also ensures that we have perfect contact with the irregular dimensions of the borehole diameter or whatever it is there. And also, if we go a little bit down to the VSP, the flexibility of the VSP allows creation of hydraulic continuity between the liquid in the unsaturated material of the vedo zone to the sampling port, which is inside. This is more or less, it's very simple, this is more or less the technology that we use for that. And I didn't want to get much into technicalities, but because it's easy for me to get into there, I'm getting driven to nuts and bolts. I didn't have enough Lego when I was a kid, so I'm playing today. But anyhow, I'll be happy to talk about nuts and bolts later after I'll show the capability of monitoring. And if this answers, I'd like to go back, if you allow me, to the presentation. And I can't remember on which slide we were. I will jump, go first over there.
You were on slide 21, I believe.
Yeah, we were on 21. We were on 20. On slide 20, I showed results from a single fly and a single flood of that system. So we measure the surface, the vedo zone, the variation in water content. This is only water content. We will show later about the chemistry of the water. and the response of groundwater below. And on the next slide, we see the set of floods or the sequence of floods in the same site during the entire season. This is from January 2006 to March 2006. This is the rainy season there. And the data we saw was related to flood number one on the left side, both on land surface, vessel zone, and groundwater below. But what we see that we can go through the entire season and measure flood by flood, and we can talk a lot about the hydrological, like the geological meaning of it, of the result, and of course, two hydrologists will always have at least four opinions about every chart they see, and they can argue about it for days, but this is not my intention now. What I show is that there is an important, valuable data that can come out from there, and then we can argue about it. On the right side, you see a table with calculated fluxes, but calculated fluxes by variety of methods. One method is, of course, what we measure in the vessel zone. This is the second row of the table. And surprisingly, it's not far from what we measure by completely independent methods as water table rising rate or increase in groundwater storage. So for us, this was an indication that what we measure in the vessel zone reflects actually the real infiltration and recharge process. This is from one site, one project where we had about 8 sites in this particular project, both in South Africa, in Israel, and in Spain. I will skip to the I'm showing this because this is clean and smooth to show, but there is very similar data from a variety of sites. I will move to the next slide, slide number 2, where we measure the same thing, only here it is under reservoirs. But these were infiltration reservoirs that were built to enhance infiltration in designated area. In this particular slide, it is from the Arava Valley, Israel, where 6 reservoirs like that built there. And what you see on the picture is 2 white arrows aiming to the right lower corner. This is where we installed 2 monitoring systems under the reservoir, just to measure how much water actually infiltrates down from the reservoir during flood event. For us, it was an extreme opportunity because we installed the system on a clean, fresh reservoir. Actually, it was clean from any remains of sediment, and for any practical purpose, we can say this is a virgin reservoir, and what we see here is how its infiltration capacity developed with time. So we'll see what happens with the first flood, and we'll see what happens with the next flood. Let me go to the next slide, slide number 23. And what we see is what people saw before us on land surface. This is during the first flood in January 2004. You see on the chart, the red curve represents the reservoir water level. At the beginning, we see that the water jumps up to about 1.8 meters. In about 2 days, the water level is dropping fast. And then the rate of water level decline is lowered significantly. Actually, if I will draw here the evaporation line, it will fall just exactly on that line. So it means that we have 2 days of grace period of filtration, and then it's blocked. But this wasn't enough to people who built this reservoir. They wanted the smoking gun from underneath. What's happening in the vessel zone below it? And we can go for the next slide. This is slide number 24. What we see here is water content profiles. On the left side, we see these profiles propagating through a couple hours to about 9 days. And we see that in 9 days, we reach maximum water content. But then on the right side, we see that those water content profiles are shrinking with time. though the reservoir was left with water for about almost 6 months. And this is only during the first flood. After it was cleaned, it was an operation of cleaning that took 6 months and many millions of dollars. If we go to the second flood, this is in 9 months later, we see very similar profiles, only that this time the Vedder zone is disconnected from the flood above much quicker. In about a couple of days, the water content in the Vedder zone starts to shrink off. And though the water level, the water on surface stays as is, the Vedder zone below is getting less and less water with time. And of course, the reason is obvious, something that everyone could tell before they build it. Floods in arid environments, we can go to slide number 26, brings a lot of silt with them, silt and clay. And these silt and clay build up on the reservoir bottom and seals off the bottom. This is almost obvious. This is what you see here, this block on the right side on the back of the truck. This is from a single flood event. Actually, this is the first flood event that hit this reservoir. So, again, we can argue about the meaning of the data, but clearly we have data that shows that the reservoir is not infiltrating as it was built for. So, up to now, it was the chemical composition. Let's move to slide number 27. Sorry. Up to now, we talked about only the dynamics of infiltration through measurement of the water content. If we move to slide number 27, we'll try to see what's happening with the chemistry of the water or our ability to collect water samples that will later be analyzed to whatever, whether it is contaminants or tracers, as we use for this experiment. Only that this time, the experiment was done in an area which is much more complex hydrologically to at least understand the infiltration process. You can see on the right side the picture of a typical cross-section from the area. Very coarse, very heterogeneous, made of gravel in sandy or clay matrix with a lot of interbeds or fine layers of clay and silt, as usually happens in arid environments or stream channels in arid environments. So what we have here, you can see on the left side, below the surface on the left corner on the bottom, we see a schematic illustration of the system installed in the subsurface. Only that this time we have, in addition to the water content sensors, we also have VSPs, Vedder Zone Sampling Ports, that allows us collecting water samples. On land surface, we had a pond or a pool, which we had in the middle of this pool, infiltration rings. And these rings were traced with chemical tracers for a very short period. So we could look at the dynamics of infiltration both through the wetting and both through the breakthrough curves of tracer in deep sections. Is there a question there? Because I hear some noises.
No questions. There have been some online questions which we can go through if you'd like, but nothing so far.
I will go on to slide number 28. This slide is very similar to what you've seen until now. On the left side, we see water content variation with time in that particular site. Of course, as expected, in such a site, it is not as homogeneous as we saw before. The water front is propagating in stepwise, and the velocity is not homogeneous. Now let's see what's happening with the breakthrough curves, and for it we go to slide number 29. Now we see the setup. On the right side we see the picture of the infiltration rings. The pond was flooded. We kept the same water level both inside and outside the rings, only that we have traced the water in those rings for a short period of about 20 minutes. You can see the period on the left side through the chart, the gray area on the chart on the left side. And what we can see is the breakthrough curve of all craters applied on surface in variable depth. So we can tell exactly when the tracer arrived, and moreover, we can tell exactly when the tracer left that area and left us with clean water coming from above. Of course, it is complex because the upper part seems like clean and nice breakthrough curves that we can easily model, but if we go down, we can see bizarre pattern of double peaks. Of course, there's explanation for that, and there is a paper that was published in 2009 in the Verozone Journal presenting the meaning of these double peaks in such a domain. But anyhow, my intentions now were not to discuss the dynamic, the hydraulic mechanism, just to show that we can measure breakthrough curves of whether it is tracers or contaminant or clean water in variety of depths. We can move to the next slide. And here we see tables where we can calculate velocities and fluxes not only on the basis of the variation in water content, which is good, but also due to arrival of tracers and the breakthrough in various depths. So we can think of it again, tracers for just for, you know, scientific studies, or we can go for looking at contaminants, for instance, leak from somewhere that appeared somewhere and disappeared later on in the Weddell zone, and not only as we find it in groundwater later on after it accumulated in the groundwater. We can also go on to the next slide. What I showed until now was something that was measured in relatively shallow, if we can call it shallow, Weddell zone of 4, 5, 6, 7 meters. Now I'd like to go deeper to a cross section of 21 meters. This is almost 60 feet below surface, in a site where we wanted to investigate dynamics of water percolation or rain-induced water percolation in sandy area on the coastal plain in Israel by the city of Ashdod. You can see the urban area behind the picture. So the site in the subsurface looks more or less as you see on the schematic illustration on the right side, and I will present some of the data from one of these systems, but practically it's very, very similar. There is a paper down below here for those of you who want to see more information about this particular setup. We can go now to slide number 32, to data from one of these leaves. What we see on the right side is the cross-section log. It is composed of sand and then clay layer at 6 meters and then sand and then loam and then sandstone and a normal cross-section of up to 21 meters. What we see on the left side is the water content variation in time of two upper probes at 1.4 meters. This is the pinky one, and the 0.6 meter, this is the blue one. Down below on the same chart, we see the black columns, which represent the rain. The rain, the daily cumulative rain during the entire season. This is a single season from October to April. What we can see, that the first few rains do not really affect the Weddell zone. It probably soak up the upper soil and do not penetrate much. But as soon as a significant rain event step in, we get a kickoff of the water content of the upper probe. And then immediately, a quick drainage. Is it drainage or evaporation? We know if we compare it to the one below it at 1.4. We see that once the probe at 60 centimeters starts to drain, the probe below it starts to gain water, actually producing wetting waves down there, and we can see that these wetting waves now proceed on from rain event one to another through the entire season. And this is data that is collected every couple hours or couple minutes, depend on the sequence you want to download your data logger, But practically, you can in any timing. But this is only the two upper poles. Let's look a little bit further down for the dynamics of it. Probes at 3 and 6 meters. Again, we see wetting waves. This is slide number 33 I'm looking at now. We see two probes at deeper sections, and we see the dynamics. We see that the big first event actually kicked off the first probe at 3 meters, and then its drainage is affecting the probe below at 5.5 meters. But then, when the next rain event comes in, they both kick up really fast and shooting down wetting waves. And these wetting waves are what we see all the way down. And this now will jump to the next slide, slide number 34. Now we see a bunch of hydrographs from a single system. And we can see how wetting waves are progressing along the Vedo zone. We can see how they behave in the sandy material of the upper 6 meter. We can see how they cross the clay material at about 7 meter. But nicely, we can see on the green figure, the green curve at the lower chart, by the end of March, more or less, we see a small kickoff of water content at depth of 21 meters, meaning that the wetting front progressed through the entire cross section and all the way reached the bottom. This information tells us about the dynamics of the entire percolation process as it happens in reality, in real situation, in real setup. We can go to the next slide, slide number 35, because people are asking, this is one system, what about the other system? Here we see data from all of the systems where we plot on the chart the first arrival of a wetting front to any probe in the Vedo zone. And what we practically see, how the wetting front propagates through the season from land surface depth zero to depth of 21 meters at about 4 months. Slowly, slowly, event by event, it progressed all the way down. Again, this was all about water contents and nothing about the quality. Now let's see what's happening with the quality of the water in this site. And I'd like to remind you that this site is in a sand dune area, in an area which is supposed to be very clean, not contaminated, but not far from away from the sea, and sees only rainwater, no agriculture, no industry, not even smog or something like that. This is a clean area. And we can jump to the next slide, slide number 36. What we see here is chloride profiles. But these profiles were collected out of soil samples, which were collected during drilling. We drilled in the site, in the middle of this bunch of systems. We drilled, and by auger, we collected soil samples or sediment samples, and extract them with water to something which is very naive and not very contaminated. As we see, this is chloride. So we see pretty much low concentration as expected in this area, between 60 to 100 milligrams per liter. These concentrations are normalized to, of course, to the water content of the sediments. This is expected. This is a clean area. And there's no much vegetation, no much evaporation, and life is good. But then, if we move to the next slide, slide number 37, we see the chloride concentration on the left side of water in water sample collected by the Vedo zone sampling ports, and here we present only four profiles from November 2006, January 2007, April, through half a year, or more than half a year. Practically, I could plot here 4 years of continuous sampling of 2 weeks to two of sampling campaigns that take place every 2 weeks to 2 months, depend on the season, and they all just fall one on top of the other. Which means that what we sample is far away in concentration, much lower in concentration than what we get from sediment extract. Now, this is not an arid area. This area gets about 500 millimeters of rain per year. In a sandy, quartz sand, sandy area, all the rain comes in few events, high intensity events, no runoff, and everything is infiltrating down. So for us, the right side, the black squares, represent soil sampling. On the other hand, what we see on the left hand is actually the mobile phase of the water that keep going through the Weddell zone. Now, at the beginning, we thought this is some kind of an artifact, maybe something that's purifying our water on the way down. But if we go to the next slide, slide number 38, we can see encircled there samples collected from an observation well located in the middle of this nest of Weddell zone sampling systems. And we see that the chloride concentration of this water, because in the sand dune area in the middle of the mound, of the water mound, has the exact same concentration of what we measure in the Weddell zone. So for us, this is an approval that what we measure in the Weddell zone is actually the concentration of the water moving in the Weddell zone and not the bulk potential of the salt in a sediment sample. Now, since this is a clean area and the concentration are almost like rain concentration, our profiles are on the left side, which means cleaner. On the other hand, if you are in a contaminated side, of course, the mobile water may have much higher concentration than the total bulk. So this tells us something about the efficiency of the sampling to determine the concentration of the mobile water. Again, just taking a soil sample, extract it, and try to understand the dynamic process of water and contaminant transport. From here, I would like to move to the last section of this presentation, because I know my grace period with you is dropping down now quickly. This is our 45 minutes. This is related to remediation. Only in the U.S., there are, I think, 450,000 sites which are already characterized as contaminated sites. This is according to the EPA, at least. And whenever there is contamination, of course, we know we start with, as we said at the beginning, with characterization, and we know that the site is contaminated. Now, the EPA today demands, at least in many, many places, active remediation. Most remediation is done today by bioremediation. There's also chemical, but let's talk for instance on bioremediation of polluted Weddell zone. We know a lot about it from the laboratory, in vitro, and we know what's supposed to be the best or the optimal degrading condition. So what we usually do, we'll take care of the upper soil, remove the source of contaminant, and take care of the upper soil, maybe do it ex situ, excavate the first couple meters, and take care of it in ex situ. But what happens if the Weddell zone is 20, 30, 40 meters, as in this example? We can move to the next slide, slide number 40. And what is the technology used in most sites today? Usually it is related to manipulation of the hydrological and chemical condition on surface, either by flood irrigation or drip irrigation or sprinklers, adding few chemicals to help the germs develop, and finally eat also the contaminants. We hope that by manipulating condition on land surface, we will be pushing both water and chemicals down the vedo zone to get optimal condition as we have learned in the laboratory. But actually, today we don't know much about the dynamic process or whether we reach the real conditions in the vedo zone. We don't know much about it. We do what we do, and 2 months ago I heard the term said, poke and hope. So you do what you do by the book, and then you take soil sample or bring an Odex machine or drilling or geoprobe or even a sophisticated sonic drilling, collect many samples, analyze them by, and you all probably know how much expensive is soil extraction, especially for chemical composition of organic material. But you don't know what are the chemical, the active condition that leading to that. What I will show now is a project where we do the same as everybody did before us, but only that now we are also relying online monitoring of the actual hydraulic and chemical conditions continuously. So we manipulate condition on land surface and see how it affects the vedo zone, and then tweak the parameters on land surface in order to fit what we measure inside. And here I'd like to go to the next slide, slide number 41. This is an example from a site where the vedo zone is contaminated by fuel. This is a gas station, leaks from a gas station, typical gas station in Tel Aviv. Plenty of these also similar exist in downtown Los Angeles or anywhere else in New York, or I believe those exist in many places, old leaking tanks. So this is from pollution caused by leaks of gas, but we have the exact same setup in a place where we go for remediation of perchlorate, which is a completely different material, which needs actually the opposite reducing condition in order to cause finally bioremediation of perchlorate. But the concept is very similar. If we go to the next slide, we see the beginning. On the left side, we see a big pit where the upper soil was excavated for ex situ treatment. On the bottom of this pit, chemicals were implemented. This is a powder that's supposed to provide oxygen for water that will be infiltrating by drip irrigation that was placed on the bottom of this pit, then it was covered with clean soil on top of it. On the right side, you see a schematic illustration of the monitoring system that was installed underneath this pit. This is a kind of a picture that is taken from below, okay, from, let's say, looking from the water table up to the surface. If we go to the next slide, we see the sleeve prior to its installation. This is probably 3 hours of, I would say, a couple of days of preparing in the laboratory, maybe 3 weeks to two people, and then preparing it for about an hour in the field. A couple hours later, it's already in the borehole. The borehole is sealed, and what we get is what we see on the left side. This is the control panel that provide us information every couple hours on the water content, and by the cell, the set of valves and pipes that you see on the left side of the picture, we can get water samples every day or every couple hours, depend on the water content actually, but during the actual remediation, we collect sample every couple days just because we don't have enough money for so many water samples analysis. We can go on for the action at slide number 44. And what we see is, here is a picture that's similar to what we've seen before. What we see is hydrograph, water content variation with time, at various depth. You see the first one is a depth of 6.4 meter, just below the pit that was digged out. Then you see a set of probes all the way to the water table. Actually, there's another one which is not here, but all the way to about 20 meters. but what you see her up to a depth of 70 meters. So we see that in by the moment we open the valve to the drip irrigation, we can see almost immediately that water content starts to rise up in the Vedo zone. And it's rising up, we know exactly to what is the water, the volumetric water content, which is the maximum that the bacteria can lean on. If the bacteria need more than that, they will not get. It doesn't really matter how much we open the tap. This is the maximum that they can get. We know also how long it takes for the wetting front to arrive at the bottom. This is the what's the name of this color?
Blue.
It's not blue, it's
sky blue.
Sky blue. No, it's got different names. I don't see it now.
Azul,
something like that. At depth of 16.8 meters, we know exactly where the water, when we reach maximum water content. Actually, we could stop irrigating here now, because for the bacteria, they don't need much more than that. But let's see what happened with the chemical compound, or the chemical concentration of the infiltrating water during time. And we can go on for the next slide. This is slide number 45. And we see here only through a demonstration. Of course, we can analyze to many other parts, but I will show here only concentration of few components that were taken out from the water sample. This is water samples from the Vedo zone taken every time my technician wasn't lazy enough to go out to drive from the Negev to Tel Aviv to collect the sample. But it, you see it in a period of 2 weeks to a few weeks between one to another, but practically the sample can be collected in one day. Actually, we operated from 200 kilometers away from there, from the office. We turn on the pump to start sampling. But what we see is how the profiles change with time. The upper left corner show us something which is very encouraging. We see that MTB, after the MTB is the most soluble one here, and most washable, I call it. And we can see that in a matter of a couple of weeks, we see a significant reduction in concentration. We don't see it always in all components, but I can tell you that this was the first wetting event. Later on, we have other events, which are not shown here, but I'm not here to show you whether this remediation is successful or not successful, just to show you that we can know what are the conditions to tweak the parameters to make it more reasonable. For instance, if we know that we reach maximum water content in 2 days while leaving the tap for 2 months and maybe wash the Vedo zone instead of letting it biodegrade.
And waste water.
And waste water and contaminate groundwater below. On the other hand, if you want to know if this is biodegradation or washing, we can go to the next slide, slide number 46, where we look at the isotopic composition of some of the selected VOCs. This is the isotopic composition of MTB, benzene, and toluene that you see here. This is only one setup, but with time, we can tell that if biodegradation actually happens, we should start seeing some change in isotopic composition. We don't see it here now because this was the first event, but we are hoping to see this in the future. So I think through now I showed a couple examples of the ability to get information about the hydrological and the chemical composition of the Vedo zone and to learn about the dynamics of it. And if you can go to the next slide, and if there is a take-home message that I would like to leave here to the audience, is that the next slide, slide number 47, this is a demonstration of what I believe is supposed to happen either in the next weeks, if I'll be happy, or in the next months or years or decades to come, because we cannot anymore rely only on observation wells in order to monitor what's happening in the Vedo zone. We can, and it, I hope I convinced you in some of it, that we can continuously get information on dynamic processes of both the infiltration and transport in the Vedo zone. where it is applicable. There is a list of it on the next slide. This is slide number 48, which actually ends up my talk. And we can see the potential application, and you name it, and every day I hear about other applications that it can fit in, even not related to an environment, and some of them related to the industry, mining industry, and so on and so on. And you can see it can be, can tell us what's happening under landfills, under fuel tanks in gas stations, not only wait for it to appear as gasoline in groundwater, but maybe it's already leaking in the weather zone, hazardous waste from tank storage, lagoon, sensitive factories for whatever it is, and of course online remediation, which can shorten up the remediation duration, save time on the way, and show the process for the landowner. Is it going good or not doing anything? Not less important is that the system can be installed on any existing facility, because we go, most of the sites we go in slanted borehole or even something in different angles, and by the end, once the system is there, it takes more or less a day for its installation. The owner doesn't even know if we get there or not. The data comes electronically, and from a time to time we still need to get there to collect samples, but this is a couple minutes process from the control panel. And by that, I can conclude, I can say that we have experience with that system for over 10 years. Some of the systems are already active for more than 7 years, still producing information in the same quality as it did in the first years. It started as my bizarre thought at the university, but now we have a commercial company, it's called Amethyst, that we are trying to spread the word that we can do a lot of efficient monitoring in the weather zone for the sake of both prevention and health remediation. And I think I've been talking too much. Just I want to thank you all, especially to you, Jean, for all the effort around it, and for, I don't know if you are still there, but very much for being there.
Oh, they are definitely still here, and I've got a list of some questions that have been submitted throughout your talk. So if you don't mind, I think I'm going to start reading through some of the questions that have been submitted electronically. Is that okay?
Oh, sure.
Okay, great. I'm going to, a number of them came in when we took the first break, and they're getting into the specifics of the limitations of where or when you cannot apply this particular approach. So the first one that I'll pose to you comes in from New York, it's actually coming out of the EPA, and they ask, what are the limitations of which types of rock that you can use this approach with, if any limitations exist?
You could see, we used it in a variety of setups. From, you know, very loose sand dunes to long to area of very heavy clay, fractured clay, to gravelly material in arid environment. The first limit, 2 weeks ago, I could be very bold and say no limitation. But 2 weeks ago, I found one limitation, which actually we solved. This is when you hit a layer which is extremely unstable. For instance, very loose material which is saturated, and the material keep collapsing. Out of about 60 boreholes like that and 50 systems that installed until today, this was the first time we had such a terrible collapse, but we solved it by drilling with casing, putting the system with the casing, and then pulling out the casing. So we had few collapses in few spots. Actually, out of a weather zone of about 42 meters, we had one collapse at about 6 meters and one collapse at about 3 meters. All the rest stays as is. So with this collapse, we solved it by using casing and then pulling it out and letting the natural material collapse on. Of course, all the rest of the borehole was filled, as it's supposed to, with high-density concrete, which, as I said at the beginning, is doing two things. First, it's opened the sleeve, and the pressure also restores tension release cracks in the borehole and fill the borehole. We have some
even though the collapse, the system is okay now.
Yeah. The system now is okay, is working. I can say that I do not have much experience in solid rocks, just to be honest, but I can say that some of the first prototypes were built and designed for solid rocks, where we installed similar systems in just in front of the fractures. So as long as you can drill, we can install. Even if it is loose, unconsolidated material from sandy material to gravel to rock. So I don't see the limitation. One limitation that people may ask, hey, what about the depth? The system is designed in a way that there's no depth limitation. My experience until now is to depth of 50 meters, which is 150 feet, but there's no technical limitation of going
165 feet.
But the system can easily be extended to deeper sections of the vertical zone if needed. Not that I have experience with that now, simply because nobody paid for me until now, either as through grants to the university or through our company. But if a need comes to that, I think we can solve that. The system is pretty robust, as I hope I showed here.
Okay. Great. The next question comes in from Syracuse, New York, and they ask, the monitoring projects presented in the photo seem to require a lot of manpower to install. Will you discuss the relative costs of the installation of these systems? And is this information being utilized on projects that are being driven by environmental regulations?
Yes. The manpower is actually not an issue, because what you saw in this picture is the manpower needed for half an hour of just taking up the sleeve and dropping it into the borehole. So any hitchhiker in the area, the operator of the drilling truck, people that came just to see the show. Technically, we don't have now a factory that built it, but we are on the way for that. To construct it, after we got all the material that we get from different vendors that custom it for us, there's one or two technicians. Actually, these are not real technicians. These are students, as you know. They're all left-handed. But anyhow, some of them are really good. It takes about 2 weeks to build a system for two people, walking slowly, answering emails, calling their wives and all that. And by the end, in the field, it takes about a couple hours of drilling, about 2 hours to 3 hours to drill the borehole even to about 50 to 60 meters. Let's call it a day. All the people you saw in the picture just sitting beside, eating, talking, and by the end we need them for about a couple minutes just to lift up the instrument and drop it into the hole. Not because it is heavy, just because it's like a Chinese dragon. And for now, we haven't invested much in making, you know, big reels that will drop it down. We are on the way to industrialization of that. That is going to be much easier. Once it is in the borehole, we need two people to go on with it for continuing the installation, setting up the control panel, and from then on, it's it comes of a lot of data gets by cell phone modems, and of course we have problems from time to time that some modems stop to work, but usually because the solar panel is full of bird poops. But anyhow, by the time it's in the ground, It's pretty resilient. About the cost. We don't know what is the real cost. I can tell you what is the cost as it happens to us. Until now, I did it through scientific projects or through projects funded by environmental agencies in Israel. It's either the Water Authority, most of it from the Water Authority, some of it even through the environmental, the Israeli EPA for that. But practically, the project on the influence of agriculture on groundwater and investigating the influence of dairy farm on groundwater, and some of the project on the influence of or the effectiveness of reservoirs come from the governmental agencies. Some of it come from scientific foundations like the Israel Science Foundation, the European Commission, the Six Frameworks, which funded the project, and from International Arid Land Consortium, BNBF, which is a German consortium. So there are many of them. How much it costs? As a company that we have just established a couple of months ago, we think today that it is about, the system costs about $45,000, not just for the system. We talk about the system, installation, and a service for about 3 years. Well, the service is not just service to make it work, it's the service of monitoring and providing the relevant reports on that, the periodical reports. Of course, every project...
Like you saw in the slides.
Yeah. Of course, every project got its own specification and its own needs and own number of required fees. It depends on the site, but in general, it would run around $45,000 per system. And if you know how much cost any project of remediation, so you can make the calculation on top of it. So again, what you saw is many people, some of them just want to be in the picture as you saw in Namibia, because there were too many people for a sleeve of 7 meters, which weighs about maybe 15 kilos to 20 kilos, to longer one where we need a lot of people just for the installation. I think, I hope I answered by that, or?
I think you did. I think you did a great job on that one. The next one, though, is going to come in from California, and they ask a specific technical question about how you would differentiate between condensate that occurs on the well casing and water percolating through the vadose zone.
Please, can you repeat that?
The question asks, how do you differentiate, or how do you tell the difference, between condensate, which would occur in the well casing, and then water percolating through the vadose zone?
There is no well casing. There is no well casing. Think of it as something that goes into an uncased borehole and fill up the entire void of the borehole, and nothing can move into it because it's totally filled with either two-component urethane or concrete, which is inside a sleeve which is completely sealed. You can think of it as something that water flow and hit it and bypass it underneath, but it cannot go along it, certainly not on the top of it where the probes are located, because in the vadose zone water would flow vertically and would cross it. So the borehole is completely sealed and there's no void in it. And
okay,
the flexibility of the sleeve allow it, because it is filled with liquid of high density, to fill any small cavities. And we had couple sets that we excavated out. Even we see that small, you know, small cable of the size of couple centimeters falls out of the borehole wall. The sleeve will just go inside and fill it up. We did couple tracer tests, and in places where the entire site was completely flooded to make sure that it will have some kind of flow that can run along the sleeve, and we will catch it. And we never, at least as I can, I know it's a little bit irrigant to say, but I'm pretty confident about my statement that there's no much preferential flow along the borehole wall, and the borehole is completely sealed. I may be wrong here and there, but not something that I could recognize until now.
Okay.
It is true, though, that the existence of something which is impermeable, by the way, it's very narrow. It's about 6 inches in diameter, less than it, it's 4.5 inches in diameter, is causing something which is impermeable in the vedal zone. So in a way, it may disturb the flow, but water would hit it and run around it and continue below it and not run along it. So it is true, though, that sometimes during the dynamic phases of the flow, we can a little bit overestimate or over our measurement will show overestimation of the water content during the wetting wave, but it will not affect the timing, and only the maximum water content during the peak may be shifted in 1 to 2%. This is what we have estimated and measured until now.
Okay. The next question also comes in from California, and they want more specific details on the types of sensors that you use. Specifically, what chemical sensors are you using? What are they made of?
The sensor we are using until now are the flexible TBR. I think it was on slide number 10. You can go back to it. Flexible TBR, and you can see here on, there are I think at least 4 or 5 references to publication where we described in detail the structure of the FTDR sensor. It is patented, so you can see there, but the exact structure. The vedal zone sampling port is made of couple sections. One is a completely flexible section and porous section that allows attachment to the porous sediment, actually, and create continuity between that and a cell which is inside to allow driving water from unsaturated condition into a sampling unit, just as a lysimeter is doing, only that our lysimeter is flexible in order to get good contact between the lysimeter and the natural sediment, because the borehole walls are never smooth and certainly never flat in order to get good contact. And if you have hard material like rock or cable in front of you, there's no chance to create continuity by hard ceramic ports. And the technology here allows, by the flexibility, allows attachment and continuity between the pores in the sediment to pores of the vedal zone sampling port, the VSP. Also, we are now measuring today, we do not have sensors, in online sensors, for the chemical concentrations inside, because as you saw, there is no single machine or lab on chip that can give you full analysis of a major ion, trace, volatile compound, organic compound, or a isotopic composition as you've seen there. So today we collect samples, water samples, and analyze them in the lab for whatever we want. And the sampling frequency depend on the project specification. We also measure the redox potential, and this is something that is running now, which is very important for any remediation aspect. So we have now substantial experience with red measuring of redox potential on the water samples, but I don't have it any slides with it up, but we do measure redox potential because this tells us a lot about the effectiveness of the remediation options. Moreover, we develop sections that will allow us, we hope, to collect water samples and to collect bacteria, but this is pretty challenging, and I'm not sure I can state that we have it in hand, but we are working on it now. So we do not have chemical measurements in line now. We only measure EC, electric conductivity and stuff like that, or water content of the sediment, and analyze the water samples outside.
Okay. The next question is asking if you've ever used this technology to a site in Southern California here in the United States, and if you have, if you could identify those sites.
We do not have now a project in an active project in the United States. Actually, my first prototype was at Yuma Proving Ground in Arizona. It's still there, it's still working, but we do not have yet a real active site in the United States. I'll be happy to have it in 2 months from a phone call. But yes, I'm on the way. It was easier for me to develop it in my backyard and to show the applicability here, but I think we are ready for other places. But as I said, one of the projects was in South Africa, Namibia, and Spain, and in this part it was pretty successful. We have a couple of papers around that also presented here.
Okay. The next question, basically they're asking about the infiltration curves. And they ask that the type of infiltration curves that you were showing, are they typical for any type of soil? In other words, should we always expect to see rainwater reaching groundwater, or will it move more laterally instead of vertical or straight downward sometimes?
Of course not, because I only showed the nice data. No, but I went through a couple sets. If we can go to slide, let me find where it was here. Slide number 20. Here this is classic infiltration, very homogeneous, through homogeneous sand in the stream channel in Namibia. You can see a very clear propagation of the wetting front, because the site is made of almost homogeneous sand. Not almost, because if you look at probe number 4, you will see that the water content is much lower. This was in a layer of gravel, okay? So, of course, the water retention is much lower. But if you go to the slide number 28, this site is installed in a very gravelly formation. So, of course, it will not be homogeneous, and we see actually lateral flow. What you see here is information from one system. Actually, in this setup, we have 4 systems that are also going sideways from the stream channel. And sometimes we see the probes which are located on the side away from the water above, getting water before probes which are located just under the water. So we know that we have lateral flow. We see processes of capillary barrier and breakthrough through capillary barrier. We see lateral flow in some places where we have few components. So, of course, the setup is much dependent on the lithological condition. A site which I didn't go through was the site under the dairy farm. This is the site located in very clay material. Actually, it's a clay, 45% of clay, Mons-Morel net clay, which is a shrinking clay. Actually, what we saw, that water is running through the fracture to depth of 6-7 meters, actually reaching down the groundwater, with no filtration of the soil at all. And the bulk soil, the matrix, is not even, the water is not even moving through that. And all the water is running through the fracture. So we can go from very homogeneous flow, as we see under the sand dune, to something which is very heterogeneous as the gravel, and end up with in a system which is in a fractured domain, where we catch the effectiveness of the infiltration through fractures in a zone which is supposed homogeneous but is far away from that.
Okay, great. Our very next question comes in from Michigan, and they ask if you've done any testing for PPCPs.
Not yet. I haven't done yet. I didn't only. Now we are running on looking at on the project through pesticides, hydrocarbons, perchlorate, but not yet through that. But I see no reason why not. I just need to adapt the right construction material of the system for that.
Okay. The next question is coming in from Delaware. And they want to know, how much does a typical gas station installation up to a depth of 21 meters cost, if you're excluding your laboratory costs?
On that, when you have a gas station, there is a common question about how many system you need per acre or per, we use dunams here, or per a certain surface area. Well, it doesn't go by the surface area. A gas station got specific potential points where leaks can start from. Of course, we will not go to install a system under the grocery shop or the convenience store in the gas station. It's either the area of the tanks or the pump. So these are very specific areas that usually 3 to 4 systems of such a domain can cover. Of course, it also depends on the material, on what is the geology of the area. So we cannot just say straightforward 3-4 systems. For instance, the system like in Tel Aviv, where we know it is layers of sand and clay and loam, and the infiltration is usually vertical, usually about 2 systems per designated area would be fine, and then we add to the tanks, and then we add to another place. But it depends on the site, but on the average, we can say 3 to 4 to maximum 4 systems per gas station. For typical gas station, of course, if a gas station is huge or it is a complex of gas station, this is maybe something else. But if the tanks are situated in one place and the pumps in one place, it can make life easier.
Okay. The next one is a sort of a more comment as well as question coming in from California. And they state that in their experience, suction cup bisimeters have had limited success as an early warning system for monitoring contaminant releases in the vadose zone. And that's particularly for the detection of volatile organic compounds. They're asking you to please describe how water samples are collected from the ZIP BMS and how your system would differ from a basic suction cup bisimeter.
Basically, the concept behind suction lysimeter is the same, only that our suction lysimeter are designed to collect water sample from a much larger surface area. It is installed under, it is not installed at the bottom of a vertical borehole. It is installed practically under a column of undisturbed sediment. So this is a point on the upper side wall of the slanted borehole. As I showed, it collects water samples. And if your water content is very low, then we will not be able to collect water samples. Because with lysimeter, you can collect water only if you have high enough water content. But as I showed in the data from the sand dune area in Ashdod, we collect water samples throughout the entire season or entire year. In the summertime, where the water content is dropping to 6, 7, 8 to 9%, maximum 9%, it takes us about a month to 2 months to collect 100 cc of water. But then also during this period, there's no much action of infiltration. Everything is much slower. Nothing moves. But if something moves as liquid, then the conditions for sampling it is rising dramatically. And then in wintertime, once the wetting front are passing through, we collect water samples in a couple hours. Like in the site under the gas station, where there is a drip irrigation, which is open for about, I think 2 hours a day, was open during that time for about, I might be wrong, 2 to 4 hours a day, we could collect water sample in a matter of about 6 to 12 hours. So, of course, the ability to collect water sample depended on the water content. But then when the water content is low enough, nothing much happens. Now, how it is different from getting gas concentration from gas sample, where gas is driven, the conductivity for gas is much higher. And you don't really know always where it's coming from. While you collect water sample during infiltration, you know it's coming from above. And when we collect the water sample is stored, is always disconnected in a way. We make it in a way that the sampling section is divided to few sections. One area is collecting the water, another section is actually storing the water. It is disconnected from the atmosphere, it is disconnected even from oxygen because we use either nitrogen or something else to collect the sample. So it is stored in a cell, in a sealed cell, away from the porous section and away from the atmosphere. So we think that by collecting water sample, the chemical composition, even for volatile, is representing what's happening in the water sample. Of course, water sample is in some kind of dynamic equilibrium with the volatile phase, and this is a question, but it has advantage over gas, has also disadvantage over gas. But the advantage over gas sampling is that you collect exactly what's coming up from above and not from anywhere around.
Okay. The next question is actually coming in from New Zealand, and they ask, and they say, first of all, thank you for a very interesting presentation, but that they have a question concerning the water chemical readings from the sleeve. And they say that based on slide number 10, it appears that water is collected within the sleeve. Is this water evacuated afterwards, or do you have to work out the next composition from an accumulated chemistry? If the water is accumulated, you were just mentioning about a 10-year monitoring program. Would this impact the longevity of the system?
Okay. First, I'd like to thank them for the question. This is a good question. Actually, the water is not collected in the sleeve. The sleeve is just a shuttle. In the sleeve, there are sampling units. And the sampling unit is very, very, very small. It's made of either Teflon or made of stainless steel, and we use material which are relevant for the site. For instance, in the site you see on slide number 10, on the picture on the right side, this sleeve is made of PVC because we were only interested in the major ions just to see the infiltration process. But in other sites, where it is contaminated with gasoline, we use material which are much more resilient for not be attacked by the compounds by the organic compound. So we use their specific type of urethane for the sleeve, The inner part of the sleeve is completely sealed. Nothing sees the inner, it's just concrete. The water samples go through either pure quartz, which was washed and burned in the oven, and passed through stainless steel, and then through Teflon pipes. So we do not have much experience in chemical changes because of the sleeve, and the sleeve is not supposed to affect the chemical composition of the water. Of course, there are exceptions. In any site, we need to adapt the right construction material to the chemical setup or the chemical situation at the site itself.
Okay. The next question comes in from Illinois, and they ask, how are you determining volumetric water content?
TDR technology is it's the most widespread used method to measure water content. It's measuring actually the electric properties of the sediment, which is somehow related to the water content by the dielectric properties of the water. And practically, we use TDR systems as everybody uses it, either as I know that in Israel most farmers use it in their field just to compensate the irrigation process. So it's a very common technology using TDR or something which is similar to that. Our special design allow us to take the TDR, which is usually used for shallow soils, and bring it over to deep sections of the weather zone. But TDR as technology allow measuring the volumetric water content around the sensor, just because the water got the electric properties, which are much different in the electric properties of the soil. This is something which is pretty standard.
Okay, great. The next question comes in from Toronto, in Canada, and they ask, how do you ensure that the sampling points are on the upper surface or hanging wall of the borehole?
We send a little mouse down there. No. As you can see in sleeve number 10, this dragon is built in a way that it's flexible only up and down. So if the last guy will start to turn it clockwise or counterwise, the whole system will rotate with it. So while we insert it down, we make sure that it goes with the probes up, and it's always leaning up, and if it starts to move to one direction, we can, on the way down, start rotating it to the right direction. As I said, we already excavated a few of them, and just to make sure that this is what's happening, and we never had any mouse running all the way down, but we think this is what's happening according to our experience and according to the method we are using and the type of flexibility, which is only up and down but not right and left.
Okay. The next question comes in from actually EPA up in Chicago, and they ask, once the system is installed, how would the cost of taking water samples compare to other sampling methods, excluding the laboratory costs? And this is a multi-part question, so I don't know if you want to address that one, and then I'll move on to the next few parts.
10 minutes of technician time. That's all it takes, and the cost of the bottles. The rest is the analysis in the laboratory. And this is well dependent on what you want to analyze. If you want to analyze for major ion, or you want to analyze for VOCs, or you want to analyze for isotopic composition, you can run from $100 a sample to $500-$600 a sample, depend on, or $800 a sample for isotopic composition. So this is much dependent of what you want to do. But the sampling itself, 10 minutes of technician, not even well trained, you just need to get there with about these bottles and switching valves up and down, and a couple minutes with the system, and you got a set of bottles ready to go up to the lab. There was a question before that I didn't answer about the timing. Some of the systems are already more than 10 years down there. The system that we collect water, I need to be honest, only 5 years, and they keep on working as they did in the first day. So we can collect water samples depending on the water content outside. As I said, in summer it can take months or months, and in winter it's a matter of minutes or hours to fill up 100 cc for water analysis.
Okay. The next question is also from the same person, but they ask, would the system be workable on the glacial till aquifer?
No, I didn't use it yet in till, but I have experience with till. I've been working on projects in till in Denmark, and I drilled their boreholes, and I have, with my experience, there is no problem to do it. And I think practically it would work very similar to what we see in the clay formation, as I told on the project from the dairy farm, where the system is very fractured. So in such a place, of course, we will install a system with a higher frequency of sampling units, because we would like to catch the fractures. But there will be no problem, because the till is usually very, even under the water table, is very stable and would hold at least for the installation. Of course, it's not stable if you leave it a hole open for a year, but we do it in a way that the driller is going in, stays there until we are ready, he pulls out the auger flight, and 10 minutes later, we are already in the borehole. So the ability to install depends on the stability, and till seems not to to impose any problem with that.
Okay, and the final part of this one particular question asks, would the system work for measuring fluoride and hexavalent chromium concentrations in water in the vadose zone?
Any soluble material that can run with the water would pass through, and then we will be able to sample it. Again, we collect the water sample. Sometimes if you have a water sample and it is contaminated, let's say, with fuel, with gas, we get two phases of water in the water, phases of liquid in the water sample. So by the end, you get a water sample. You can do with it whatever you want. But if the material is soluble to run with the water, which will pass through. We have no experience yet with colloids or bacteria. This is something we are developing now. But I cannot say that we have it in hand. We know what to do, but if money would come for development, we'll do that as well. We think we know what to do, what kind of modification we need to do for that. So, but again, for the question, if something is soluble in water, it would come in and be collected.
Okay, great. Right now, the final question that I have coming in online, and again, we're approaching the end of our scheduled time, so we do have a few more minutes. If there are any final comments or questions, please try to get them in now by clicking on that orange question mark icon to type them up. Make sure your pop-up blockers have been disabled. We'll also take a minute or two to see if anyone who's just on the telephone lines has a verbal question or comment. But until we get there, the last one that I have here in the queue comes from Seattle, Washington, and I think you've talked about this a bit more, but again, just to make sure everyone's clear, they want to know how exactly are the water samples retrieved from the VSPs, especially the deeper ones?
Okay. Practically, the sampling unit itself, and only the sampling unit, when we want to collect the water sample, we create at the beginning, on the day of installation, we create continuity, water continuity between the cell, the porous material, the flexible porous material, and the sediment. Once we get the continuity, we start to drive water in by generation of low pressure or vacuum pressure in the sampling cell, and we started rainwater in, back inside. Once the continuity is created, water flux is coming in, evidently, and the flux is dependent, again, as I said earlier, on the water content or the matrix potential outside. In general, the water will start to run in and fill up a cell. It's not as it is. In slide number 10, it's very schematically. In general, the water would run through the porous material and pass through a set of valves into a cell where it will be stored until it will be taken up to the surface. It's taken up to the surface not by vacuum. It's taken up by pressure. So we are pressurizing the cell and getting back the water. So this is why we have no depth limitation. We are not collecting the water after the surface by vacuum. This is also, we will lose a lot of volatiles. As long as we collect water into a cell, and the cell getting filled with time, we are not losing much of volatiles, because this is a certain amount of vacuum. Well, there is no pump that keep on draining it. The entire system is completely sealed. You apply vacuum once, low pressure once, liquid is coming in. At the beginning, of course, you have some fractionation. By the end, you collect the water sample, and then you push that water sample up. Again, through a set of valves and pressure. There's pressure transducer. Actually, there's something that I didn't show here. One of the system is used even to measure the soil water potential and the soil gas pressure. So it's much more complex than what you see here on this chart. We can measure the sediment water potential or the matrix potential. We can collect the water. Usually we don't use the same one, just not to disturb the actual condition. And we push the water up and not suck it up. I hope I answered
it. Oh, you've done a great job. I thank you very much. Again, in the last few minutes that we have before we close out today, I just wanted to have anyone on the telephone line. Sounds like someone may take themselves off of mute. Go ahead and feel free to speak up. If you have a mute button, just unmute yourself or hit #6 to take yourself off of mute, and just feel free to ask a question or make a comment.
Before you go on, because I know some people are already closing in, I just want to thank you all once again, and then we can go on for the next question. But really, thank you all for being here and listening. And I wanted to use this opportunity to thank you before we are closing in. So
sure.
I'd be happy to keep on answering questions. Just I wanted to speak it out now.
No, I appreciate that. Sounded like there was a possible comment. Did someone have anything to say? Okay, I don't hear any verbal comments or questions. So with that, again, you've just made your closing statements. You just expressed your gratitude, and you're very welcome. If you have any other last statements to make, I'll feel free to do so now. Otherwise, I'll move on with the final closing statements. If people have questions or comments,
the only comment, it's not a comment, it's a closing statement. This is actually slide number 47 for those of you who are still there. I won't be saying that this is the only system. I won't be saying that this is the one and only. I can only say that we have a system working, can provide us something that we didn't have until now, which is continuous monitoring of the Weddell zone, and we cannot rely anymore only on observation wells. We must invest efforts in monitoring the Weddell zone, both for remediation and both for prevention of groundwater contamination. And if we will invest their time, we will get there. I'm pretty sure about it.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to direct everyone to the final slide, which is slide number 50 in the presentation. And first and foremost, again, we wanted to express our gratitude to Ofer for making the presentation, as well as his team members that were there with him. We do appreciate your time and your energy in coming in to share this information with our audience. I'd also like to thank our audience members who took time out of their busy schedules to sit down and listen to your presentation. There are a couple of comments and questions that have come in, mostly looking for follow-up ways to contact you or to reach out to get more specific information about your work. And with that, I'll refer everyone back to some of the links that we have available. First and foremost, if you're looking at the slides, the very top, there's a little home circle or a button with a house on it. If you click on that, that brings you back to the unique seminar homepage that was created for this event. It's the same place where you registered. It's the same place where you downloaded the materials for today. On that seminar homepage, you'll find Ofer's contact information, including, I think, his bio is up there, your telephone number, email address. And I would encourage anyone who has any comments or questions to feel free to follow up with him in that way. You can also reach out directly to me, and I'll be sure to get that information off to our instructor as well. On that final slide, slide number 50, we do have two important links that I mentioned earlier, the first one being the additional resources page that's been put together for this event. And on that slide, you can download today's, or on that page, you can get our slides from today, as well as some other references and resources that the instructors have put together. I believe there's another PowerPoint presentation, as well as a listing of some other abstracts and other publications regarding this work. So feel free to take a look at that information. You can also sign up on that page to receive announcements or alerts when we schedule future events like this one. If you're interested in attending another one, feel free to sign up for TechDirect to hear as soon as these events are made available. The other link on that page, again, is the seminar feedback form. It's very short, very simple. We do look at it. We ask that you take a minute or two to let us know what you thought of it. If you'd like to see more specific, focused, technology-based presentations, we'd be happy to continue to deliver them. We just need to know that's what you'd like to see. If you're looking for confirmation for your participation today, again, you'll get that. If you check a box on the feedback form, we'll have an email sent to you to confirm. If you have multiple persons there with you, each person can fill the form out and get a record for their own training verification that they participated today. This session was recorded, and it will be archived on the Kluwen website, and so you can check back in about 1 to 2 weeks and take a look on our training page and follow the links for the archive session. You'll see it pop up there again in about 2 weeks. If you also want to, you can sign up for a free iTunes podcast, and you'll be able to get this delivered right to your own computer or iTunes device as soon as it's ready and available up there for everyone to see. So with that, again, I want to thank everybody. This was a really great session. We had a lot of good exchange, a lot of great questions coming through, and I hope that everyone found this a valuable expenditure of your time, and I look forward to seeing or hearing from you guys on a future Kluwen seminar. So with that, I'm going to sign off, and again, thank you all for participating today, and I hope you have a great rest of the day or a great day tomorrow if you're off the bed. Thank you so very much.